Where are you, Public?
I'm in my wife's closet, Raj.
Yeah, aren't we all in a way?
Yeah, yeah, just surrounded by the blouses of my past and possibly my future. Given that there's no better soundproofing that exists in podcasting, I have found, than just that.
I think we've just created the title, at least, or maybe even the opening line for your memoir, Public. It is a joy to be with you. I have to be candid. I often listen to this podcast, and I do marvel at your emotional intelligence as a host. To me, you're the E.E. Cummings of sports broadcasting.
Look, we've all been through a lot the past year, and so I don't blame you at all for being cynical. I really don't. But if you're at all like me lately, you can kind of feel the sunshine. I mean, like right now, it's the weekend, it's summer, sports are everywhere, and July 4th is just around the corner. So today, just unwind with a life-affirming conversation with the incomparable Roger Bennett as we travel from Liverpool to Chicago to the Euros and then back to America, which may not feel the same way to you again. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, June 25th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Roger Bennett, I just want to be clear about something here. I've been waiting to talk to you for 7 years, and that's no pressure. That's no pressure at all. We shared a room at one point, and I very much doubt you even remember this, but the 7 years thing goes back to 2014. It's the spring. We're in a conference room on the Upper West Side in a Disney Global Security meeting, as they were prepping us, like in a scared straight sort of a way, before we were all headed to Brazil for the World Cup. And I just remember you being at this conference table with a laptop. I had no idea who you were at the time, but I left that meeting silently thinking, I gotta know what this guy's deal is. And so finally, 7 years later, I realize, okay, you're one half of the preeminent and celebrated and suboptimal duo Men in Blazers with Michael Davies. That is you. And also, now you have a book, Reborn in the USA, An Englishman's Love Letter to His Chosen Home, that tells me exactly what your deal is. So I am genuinely so appreciative that you're here.
I'm trying to process the different parts of this story and wonder what it was that made me stand out in this meeting. Was it in Pablo's mind, were you like, hang on a minute, do we really allow bald men to be on television in the United States? But the honest truth is, that is one of the reasons, many reasons, why I love this nation. I've always joked that I love America more than Kenny Powers loves America. So amidst the chaos of lockdown, when sports stopped, I retreated to the past and decided to write a love letter to the United States, my American story, if you will. It's a tale of wonder and love. And to be able to serve it out right before July 4th, the story is very much like, think the first half of Scarface or the last scene in Yentl. It's really the honor of a lifetime.
Well, I think the listener now understands what was so entrancing about you to me. It was the fact that you speak in paragraphs like that. And it turns out that you write paragraphs like that as well. So let's trace your trajectory here, because you end up here, but you start off in the 1980s in Liverpool. So just paint me a picture of a young Raj back in those days.
Yeah, I grew up in the magical city of Liverpool in the 1980s. It was a time of great turmoil for Britain, economic change, social change, in which the north of England was left to rot away. You know, one minute we used to have an empire, then we didn't. The mines, the steel mills, the cotton industry just fell silent. And Liverpool, the grand port, which had once shipped all of Britain's products out to the world, it really had no reason to be. A bit like Baltimore, but without the crab cake upside. And when I grew up there, amidst all this turmoil, it really felt like you could stand on a street corner in Liverpool, which had massive unemployment, really no hope, an enormous heroin epidemic. And you could feel that you could see the city decomposing before your eyes. And I survived really by telling myself I was an American born in an Englishman's body, inhaling everything American I could lay my hands on, not just the movies, the music, the books, the clothes, the television shows, a knockoff pair of Ray-Bans, but also, you know, the sports. The NFL started a broadcast, the Chicago Bears, early 80s, this team building up to the Super Bowl. And I always believed I should be in Chicago. I should be living the life that, to be quite candid, my family, when they left Eastern Europe three generations before me, they were butchers headed to Chicago, the hog capital of the world. And the family myth was they'd seen the one tall building on the Liverpool skyline when the boat docked in Liverpool to refuel, thought they were in New York, and got off thinking they were in the promised land, but it turned out not to be. So really, America existed to me as this place where life was lived in color, technicolor, while I was living very much a world in black and white.
Yeah, the technicolor aspect, Roger. I mean, part of why I love your book is because your romanticism for our country is one that has felt in recent years distant. And so just when you were thinking about, like, the Chicago Bears, for instance, like, why do you react that way, as if your soul is somehow directly connected to what can be oftentimes here, like, you know, that's just a boring cutscene. That's not the thing that we think about here in the movie of our lives, but you clearly do.
America was my light in the darkness. It was, yes, the Chicago Bears. It was the Love Boat, Fantasy Island, Heart to Heart, Miami Vice, Run DMC, Public Enemy. It was the Beastie Boys. Above all, it was Tracy Chapman. And it made America exist to me as a place where life could be lived with possibility and promise, with a different gravitational pull. To me, to put it simply, you've seen the movie Billy Elliot. My life was like Billy Elliot's, but with America playing the role of ballet dancing. And I want to be clear, I grew up as a 11-year-old, 12-year-old with the Statue of Liberty and the Manhattan skyline painted on my wall. And every night I would go to bed and arrange the curtains so that the light fell on Lady Liberty's face. And that would be the last thing I'd see. And I would dream genuinely of that wonder. And you ask about the Chicago Bears. The NFL started to be broadcast in 1982 in England. It was an hour-long show, or a highlight clip show, of the previous week's game. So this, everything was a week late, but there was no internet, so we didn't know the results. And it was largely just incredible condensed versions of the games, mostly cut to montages of Bonnie Tyler's holding out for a hero. And we would just watch in wonder at this glorious entertainment, because English soccer, football at the time, was not the glitzy product it is today in the Premier League. It was played on muddy pitches by middling men, balding men who wanted to kick each other and then retire to the pub for a beer, a pie and a cigarette. And the whole point of going, it was really about hooliganism, attended mostly by men who liked the taste of their own blood in their mouth. And when we watched the NFL, the New Orleans Saints, a terrible team coached by a man called Bum, the fans should have rioted. They never won a game, but instead they put paper bags over their heads, called themselves the New Orleans Aints, and realized sport was really about having a great time, whatever you're doing, winning or losing. The Atlanta Falcons, watching Billy White Shoes Johnson return a kickoff.
Billy Johnson has one man to beat. It's Ramsey. Johnson's still on his feet. Johnson will go.
Which was just the aperitif, an 83-yard run, so that he can do the funky chicken in the end zone.
Here he comes into the end zone, and for the second time today, he gives a little dance.
Joy, hilarity, entertainment, human wonder, and above all, the Chicago Bears. This was a team who epitomised futility. They wasted largely the career of one of the greatest players to ever play the game, Walter Payton. And then they bucked that history of self-sabotage, and with a swagger, just threw off years of doubt, of failure, of wallowing in their own misery, and became a team of destiny on the way to glory, just destroying all comers.
Walter Payton, Mike Ditka, hungry Chicago, finally champions on this January day in New Orleans.
And I watched that as a kid, and I realized you could rewrite your own history. You didn't have to be condemned to one outcome. You could take fate into your own hands. And it was really epitomized in the play of William Refrigerator Perry, the fridge. Who was a human dynamo, who could do it all, an enormous man with pace, with power, with joy. He could even dunk a basketball. He came out of Clemson. And I had a friend from Chicago posted me so much material. I was probably the only owner of the Super Bowl shuffle on 7-inch single in Britain at the time. I had a large foam hand that said Bears number one. And at Pride of Place was a poster above my bed of William Refrigerator Perry. He stood for everything that was good: versatility, belief, tenacity, and not allowing yourself to be put in one category, but being utterly singular. So the Bears, as you say, on that journey, just shone so bright as a beacon of hope for me.
So as you treat this team, the Chicago Bears, as a religious institution, basically, and I'm still kind of stuck on the Billy Elliot metaphor, to be honest with you, Raj. I'm imagining like you somehow tights are still involved, like you're still, you're pirouetting.
Dance, Roger, dance!
Yes, 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 you're doing all of this. What do your friends think? Because there's like a Prince Akeem vibe to all of this. There is a like, America, wow, like what are your fellow Englishmen thinking as this is how you are venerating this country across the ocean?
I mean, honestly, the Chicago Bears taught me one thing and Miami Vice told me another thing. When you watch that show from the perspective of England in the 1980s, your first reaction was, holy crap, teal. What is that colour? We haven't, that's not even been invented in England yet.
The Pantone colour wheel in England had a very restricted set of possibilities.
Sludge, lads, clothes come in one colour. Sludge, yeah. Put it on, wear it with pride.
A sunset in the colour of rust. Wonderful.
Don Johnson showed us that, you know, you go to these battles, you don't put on the Kevlar, you don't put on the protective gear. No, you go in pastels. You commit to pastels. You definitely don't wear socks. And what I took from that, and the Chicago Bears reinforced it by playing football in their own way, thanks to Buddy Ryan, which is when you have a singular style, commit to it and do not care what anybody else thinks. That's what I learned. And so it was critical to me right after they won the Super Bowl, a delirious night in which I tasted my first ever can of Budweiser. And spent the fourth quarter, because it was an incredibly boring game, anticlimactic, just staring at that can. And it was almost like a siren on the rocks telling me to move to America, move to America. I wanted to go almost immediately over to Chicago, which I did the summer of 1986, hellbent, determined to go and meet my heroes.
Coming up, like so many Liverpudlians before him, Raj sets sail for the land of opportunity.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way, or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So given all of this obsession, Roger, given that this country is something that energized your soul, animated your spirit from across the ocean, how did you eventually make it to our fair shores?
First of all, I had a pen pal, which young listeners won't understand. This is pre-internet. People would kill hours. It was dark. It was twisted. Many of us still use quills for writing. We'd write letters to people in foreign lands. They'd tell us about their lives. We'd tell us about ours. So my first step was I had a pen pal in Chicago. He invited me over right after the Bears won the Super Bowl. And I did, one of the greatest summers of my life, go to the northern suburbs of Chicago, Highland Park, Glencoe, the same canvas that John Hughes used for all of his movies. When I first watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off, it actually appeared to be, to me, not to be a comedy, but a documentary of my time there, which was spent going to ball games, eating, inhaling ribs, Pequod pizza, and just going up the Sears Tower. And the highlight was I got there, everything was perfect apart from the Bears, my dream, my sense of wonder, my sense of purity. Unfortunately, timing had actually gone to London for the first ever NFL game in Britain, the American Bowl against the Dallas Cowboys.
Right now in this fine old stadium, which has seen a great exhibition, a World Cup, and Olympic Games, and just 2 weeks ago, a world title fight, it's the Chicago Bears against the Dallas Cowboys at Wembley.
So I was in Chicago, where they should be. They were in London, and I couldn't believe, even worse, they seemed to be having the time of their lives palling around at Buckingham Palace and with Phil Collins. When I saw Walter Payton with Phil Collins in photos, I have never hated Phil Collins more than in that moment. And on the broadcast of the game, which I watched in Chicago, the broadcaster just mentioned, he said, the Bears are turning right round tonight, flying right back to begin preseason. And I turned to my host and I said, we need to go to O'Hare to meet them. And thank God my hosts were incredibly game and they agreed to drive at 4 a.m. in the morning to be the only people to welcome the Bears back at international arrivals. And it was there. Mike Ditka was first out with a cigar, stubbing it and waving it in people's faces, being like, leave these men alone. They are your heroes. Which, of course, I didn't listen to, just firing off my little camera flash in everybody's faces. And I met Walter Payton. His nickname, Sweetness, lived up to that. And then some. And then lumbering through international arrivals with a whole entourage was William Refrigerator Perry, the man who existed both in my imagination and on the poster that was above my bed. And he put his arm around me, Pablo, and he leant into my ear and he just whispered, dream big dreams, kid. You can do anything. I did. You can make your dreams come true. Which at the time I wrote those down as if they were words of like philosophy. And now know you live work in sports. I work in sports. I now know that is essentially the top three cliches crushed together that every pro athlete says when they go, dream big dreams, kid. You can do it, kid. But to me, that was the moment when William Refrigerator Perry told me to dream big dreams. I was just like, okay, that's it. I'm moving to America.
The fridge opens himself up to you, and inside of him, you find the beverage that finally quenches your thirst of belonging, Roger. This is an experience that propelled you to commit fully to this country. You've made a home here. You have a family. You have four American kids. And a few years ago, you become an American citizen. And that is a process that I always feel like us American-born ignoramuses, we don't appreciate that enough. So what was that moment? What was that whole experience like?
Pamphlet, just hearing you say that, I just shut my eyes when you said that. And it is still deeply emotionally overwhelming. It's the greatest day of my life to be one of 162 individuals from 47 countries in a courtroom, many of whom have escaped civil wars or famine and have undergone journeys that I can't even fathom to be here. You know, which put, to be candid, my book is very much about growing up in Liverpool in the 1980s. You know, in that moment, you realise the bare bottom spankings that I received throughout my Grey Gardens-esque English public school education and the perpetual threat of being beaten up in a late night chip shop in Liverpool after the pubs closed was incredibly tame in comparison. When you say the oath in that company, Pablo, you understand just how powerful the idea of America is, that the sense of courage, the sense of wonder, the sense of possibility, the sense of dreaming that it can and does provide. There's not a day that I'm a kid who grew up with the Statue of Liberty and the Manhattan skyline painted on my wall. I now live here. I wake up. There's not a day that I do not wake up by my wife. Thank God I'm married to her. But thank God that I live in this city. I never take it for granted, and I never will.
Yeah, ugh. Raj, I think about my parents who had to go through the citizenship process and came out of it with an appreciation that I lacked. I just remember thinking, oh, wait, you guys had to, like, take a quiz. You had to be tested to get into this. I just was born here. I woke up on third base, as it were. You had to leg out that triple. And through that perspective of someone who had to work to get here, someone who lived inside of a snow globe of American propaganda of your own creation, and then ended up finding the real thing and got to enjoy all of its complexities, what do you want Americans to know about this country that you think maybe those of us who just were born here maybe overlooked?
It is that power, that oath that we swore. When you stand in a room, when you become a new American, which is something you will never take for granted, just the power of the American dream. I wrote this book at a time of tremendous challenge for America. Obviously, lockdown, sports had stopped. The pandemic would crackle outside of my apartment in New York City, the city that I love, the city that I dreamt of being in, the Black Lives Matter summer, which everybody witnessed with its tremendous power. And ultimately, when you write an epigraph for a book, which is a funny process because it's always the most eloquent part of the book, much better than anything that I could have written. But I did use the Langston Hughes lines, "Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be." And I feel that so deeply.
Mm. It's always good, Raj, when Langston Hughes can just involuntarily be drafted as your opening act.
Oh, the undercard always trumps the always trumps the main event, always.
All right, Roger, after the break, I want to get into the Euros that are going on and whether that cynical bunch, that English side, can finally take it home.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, Roger, so the Euro 2020, and I can't believe we're still calling it that. I feel like there was just a sign budget issue that no one wanted to resolve. But in any event, it is underway. It is an enormous deal for many, as important as the World Cup. And it's 1 year late because of COVID, but big picture, just for you getting to enjoy this seemingly endless buffet of soccer after the year we all just had, what's it been like?
It's been magnificent on the sporting level. And on a human level, it's an incredible tournament, the Euros, because international football that is lived by the reality that when two teams take the field, their nation's history take the field alongside them. And let's just say in Europe, there's a lot of history. Mm. But there's the added depth of the postponement last year, which makes you constantly realize how incredible this is even happening and to never take it for granted. And I really love what the German midfielder Leon Goretzka said about the return. He said, "It's just nice that we have 82 million national team head coaches in Germany again, rather than 82 million virologists in our nation." And that really captures just the joy that we will never take for granted that this tournament's happening at all. And in most cases, in stadia that are at least half full, and that's what makes it truly magic.
Yeah, one of the scenes that kicked off this tournament from one of those stadia that was full happened with a really terrifying scene. Denmark's Christian Eriksen collapses on the pitch, Raj, and that's as scary a moment as it gets in any sport. And thankfully, he ends up doing well thanks to the medical professionals who do happen to be on site in that moment. What was your experience watching that from afar?
why do we watch sports? One of the main drivers is to escape the darkness of real life. And that Christian Eriksen's claps, the claps of an elite athlete, a beautiful, sweet, thoughtful human being, by the way, was a moment of human horror as he keeled over. The Danish team doctor later confirmed that he'd suffered a cardiac arrest and was, quote, gone before being resuscitated. And I've rarely watched a moment in sports that screamed the fragility of life in its true horror, with all the world watching together live. And that was then immediately compounded by UEFA, the organising body of European football, who essentially strong-armed the Danish team back onto the field to finish the game later that afternoon. These were shell-shocked human beings being forced to return to the scene of a collective trauma on which the field, the grass, still bore the marks of Christian Eriksen's stretcher on which their fallen teammate had lain. So that they were shell-shocked. They felt a defeat in the most devastating way. These were broken men. The goalkeeper, the reliable goalkeeper, a childish mistake that he would never make.
Schmeichel's got to be disappointed. That ball is heading for his midriff. Awful goal. Awful goal for Denmark to concede.
And then a penalty, which Christian Eriksen, had he been on the field, would have taken.
Højbjerg, saved by Hradecký. It was a very poor penalty. No two ways about that.
These were zombie men playing in trauma, and it was terrifying and upsetting, deeply, deeply upsetting to see, until just an incredible rebound that we shared together, Pablo, which really sent the spirit soaring.
Yeah, they lose that game 1-0. They lose 2-1 against Belgium, top-ranked team in the field. That's not a surprise. But they come into this match against Russia on Monday of this week needing to win by at least 2 goals to advance to the knockout round. For those who were not lucky enough to watch that game, what was that like?
It was everything that's great about sports. The game was in Copenhagen, packed stadium.
A sea of red and white everywhere we look. In this land of Hans Christian Andersen, it's Denmark who are looking to complete a fairy tale.
The fans, they've always been utterly magnificent. And to watch their team, who needed to win by 2 goals, storm into a 2-goal lead, it was delirious.
Oh, what a dreadful ball! It's a gift! It's Paulsen! Presented to him on a plate! And Denmark's got a 2-goal lead that they desperately, desperately needed in this one.
You could smell the beer, the joy just pouring out of your television screen. Then they heard that their rival Finns in the other game, they were playing Belgium simultaneously, had conceded, and just euphoria swept the ground. Honestly, it was impossible to watch without tingling.
Now a roar going around the ground, and the reason for that roar is news is ebbing through from St. Petersburg that Romelu Lukaku has scored for Belgium, and that means that as things stand, Denmark will be going through tonight.
And you felt the joy. There were beers chucked into the air. It was remarkable. But then the second wave of news broke out. That goal had been waved off.
This is proving to be a bad minute for Denmark because Lukaku's goal in St. Petersburg has been disallowed.
And worse, the Danes then conceded a penalty to the Russians, which they converted.
It's Artem Zuber providing another twist on a day full of them.
And in that second, from celebrating, it was like being at a wedding and suddenly being at a funeral, and the Danes were momentarily out. But the Danes are a tenacious collective. They charged up the field and delivered a thunder strike, an emphatic exclamation point of a goal, what we call a wolf blitzer of a shot.
And the shot from Christensen finds the net. Denmark are doing this in style. It's pandemonium in the park.
And another goal flew in. They were utterly, utterly, just buccaneeringly, swaggeringly unstoppable. And I will say, I sat there as the stadium just exhaled in joy again, in euphoria, in celebration. They had seen the darkness of life, and now they were, they knew they were making memories that they would together cross generations. Ballads would be written about this game. And watching at home, just I sat there, I will be candid, I sat there with tears, sobbing, tears of joy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this about me, Pablo, I am not Danish. I have never even, and this saddens me because I'd love to go, I've never even set foot in Denmark. But watching this football team who had been forced to play against their will in the wake of Christian Eriksen's near death, summon the tenacity to rebound, to go again, not to wilt, but to fight and win, is what makes football the greatest human theatre.
It was every bit of emotional weight that you described. And that emotional weight, those ballads that will be written, I'm now very curious, Roger, what your emotional temperature, what your songwriting heart feels like when you watch your homeland, England. Because the high hopes heading into this tournament for that side that won the group, that have advanced to the knockout round, but scored just 2 goals. What have you seen so far from them?
Well, I want to make quickly, but totally clear up front that despite my accent, I support the United States of America. And when the US and England clash, as they did in the semi-final of the last Women's World Cup, and Alex Morgan mime sipping tea after scoring a goal, a great moment in American-English relations up there with the Battle of Yorktown, or when America made Britain take Piers Morgan back. Like, I am all in. But so I can cover that, this question objectively for you, Pablo. You're really asking about England, who to me are the New York Knicks of European football. You know, I watch them play, and for 90 minutes, the thought always lingers, somehow James Dolan must own the English national team. I mean, they've got all the hallmarks of one of his outfits.
Absolutely.
Big names, big hopes, not quite gelling, underperformance, humiliation, cycle after cycle. Julius Randle would fit right into the English national team. I actually have a history on my bookshelf of the English national team, a book I read a lot when I was a kid. It kind of sums everything up about how they perform. It's called 40 Years of And we've got this coach, Gareth Southgate, a decent man, a mediocre resume, it should be said. He's in over his head tactically. Think kind of English Jason Garrett without the ginger hair.
And a lot of clapping, maybe. Is that part of the metaphor? Just on the sideline, really, really cliched but insistent body language.
You know, he's a noble, noble guy. He's great in a press conference, an incredible ambassador. It is a lot of hand clapping plus plus modfather approach to waistcoat inspired clothing choices. He's very risk averse as a result. It drives English fans mad. We see the Italians play great football. We see the Belgians dominate. France crush all comers. Why can't we do it too? And it is hard. It's super complicated. If English people cared about politics or, you know, the climate half as much as they did the English national team starting 11, Britain would be essentially run as efficiently as Scandinavia. But this is a team caught up in a storm about the balance between attack and defence, experience and youth, risk and maverick ability. And that's really where they are right now, where, yes, you could say the great thing is we qualified for the knockout round. We came first in our group. We were undefeated. We didn't concede a goal. But there's an inner Englishness which really sees the darkness that lies ahead. There's a football song that the fans sing. You will have heard it if you watch them play. It's coming home. It's coming home. Football's coming home. And I just want to be clear to Americans, because everyone says it to each other. It's coming home. Every time like somebody does something mildly good,
it's
coming
home.
Yes. Yeah, it's not coming home. It's not coming. And the people that say it know it's not. It's almost an ironic defense against the worstness of life. Do your worst. Let the English team. It's almost reassuring. If the England team crap and we crap out, and it's about managing expectations in every regard. And if you're a Chicago Bears fan and you're listening to this, if you're a Cincinnati Bengals fan, if you're an Arizona Diamondbacks fan, you know, you're nodding along. You know exactly. You know in that moment exactly what it feels like to be an England fan. There is no hope. You build the case for the best hope in your heart. You don't really articulate that. And then you just mitigate your worst possible outcome vocally. That is it. It's not just an approach to football, to be candid. It's an approach to life.
As we take this podcast home here, I want to hit on a note that I think is underneath all of the music you've been playing for us. Because what you're doing here is bridging cultures. That's fundamentally what this book and your life has been about. People here, we love you because you explain this exotic European game, soccer, to us in a way that A, makes us see its beauty, and B, makes us feel included. And the other direction is also true. You know, Americans, we love seeing you embrace our country, our traditions, our customs in ways that make us realize that this is actually something that we have underappreciated. What do you think it is about sports that allows all of that to happen?
Sports is really just the greatest telenovela. It connects everybody to a drama which is unspooling live, in which we all feel things that, I mean, I always joke that sports allows me to feel things: glory, defeat, ecstasy, agony, feelings that I imagine most normal people feel regularly in real life, but I'm dead to inside. And the reality is, sports is just a human drama. Martin Tyler, the British commentator, once told me, you know, football's a simple game. He said, when you get the ball, you can just pass, shoot, dribble. Those are really the three choices. And he said, the truly great players just make better decisions more of the time. Albert Camus was a great goalkeeper before he was a great writer. And he is alleged to have said that everything that he knows about humanity and the values of humanity, he learned by watching football. And ultimately, Pablo, when we watch football, when we watch Christian Eriksen, when we watch Harry Kane, when we watch Italy, when we watch, please God, one day the United States men be half as good as our United States women and be world beaters when that occurs. Ultimately, we're just watching humanity play out before our eyes.
Ugh, if the listener out there has Camus on their bingo card, come up and collect your weddings. Oh my God. Roger Bennett, first off, thank you for no longer being a stranger, but thank you more than anything else for dreaming big dreams.
Oh, Pablo, thank you for having me on, and thank you ahead of July 4th to be able to talk about America, the joy of my life, with you in this way. It's a real honor. To you, to all, courage.
Thank you, sir. Roger Bennett's book, Reborn in the USA, An Englishman's Love Letter to His Chosen Home, is available starting June 29th. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tumanello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Mike Philbrick, Andres Soto, Christian Gardner, Max Brodsky, Mike Farrell, Garrett Lang, and Jackson Ogilo. Oh, and one more note. I'm going to be out next week. I got some family stuff to attend to, a little vacation that is long overdue, but do not worry. I leave you in the very capable hands of our good friend, Sarah Spade.